Welcome to Power Play for April 28th, a day featuring a multi-billion dollar blockbuster deal that's giving wings to lift Canadian airline manufacturer Bombardier out of financial turbulence. We will find out if this eliminates the need for a federal government billion-dollar bailout. Also ahead on the show, he's negotiated over 100 hostage releases, and he says success is all in the ransom payments. The retired head of hostage negotiations for the federal government says the prime minister is wrong to rule out any and all release payments, and he joins us in minutes. And BC's popular premier is still under the gun for being paid a salary top-up by the Liberal Party. We'll go there for the latest fallout from Christy Clark's stipend scandal. And it's tax deadline weekend, and if the forms appear more complicated than ever, you're not wrong. A tax form guru explains why the simple task of taking your money requires so much effort. But first, at times it looked like Bombardier would never take off in the world of passenger jet manufacturing. Today, a firm $5.6 billion list price order for 75 CS-100 planes came in from mega airline Delta, and it's thrown a financial life jacket to the Montreal manufacturer, and it could have saved taxpayers a billion-dollar bailout request. Here's Transport Minister Marc Garneau dodging that very direct question.
The discussion is still going on between Mr. Baines and Bombardier. It's an active discussion, and Mr. Baines will comment on it when a final decision is taken. But I'm celebrating today a fantastic piece of news. This is a beautiful example of Canadian innovation. I couldn't be happier for Bombardier. I happen to love the aerospace world, and I think that this is the best airplane in the world.
Okay, well, but Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard, he doesn't need to be convinced. He's certain the federal government should cough up the cash.
Governments invested billions of dollars and lost billions of dollars with the support of the automobile sector in Ontario. So it would not be understandable that the federal government would not be very actively present in this innovative sector. This is the most important project, innovation project in Canada today, is a C-Series airplane. We were there, and if you ask Bombardier today or tomorrow, they will acknowledge that it is because we were there that this transaction happened.
Okay, let's bring in aviation industry expert Robert Kokonis. He's president of AirTrav Inc., an industry consulting group. All right, Robert, let's put this all in context. Does this deal, in your view, salvage Bombardier's passenger jet experiment?
Yeah, I think it does. By the way, I feel redeemed today. I was on air 2 weeks ago for Delta's first quarter earnings. We thought there's going to be an announcement that day. It didn't happen, but it looked good. Does it save the program? I believe it does. I mean, Delta isn't just a carrier the size of Air Canada. It's many times larger. And when a carrier like Delta buys, regardless of how big the discount was, and we're assuming the discount was pretty sizable, they're sending a buy signal to the broader aviation market globally that this is a good airplane.
So it's more the significance is more in the buyer, really, than the amount of money that's rolling. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, you are. You know, and we know that both Airbus and Boeing have been trying to shut Bombardier and the C-Series out of a number of deals. We saw a sweetheart of a deal with United Airlines and Boeing just a few weeks ago, upwards of a 75-80% discount on some older model Boeing 737s. So for sure, Bombardier's had to come to the table. And in fact, in their first quarter today, they booked a special $500 million charge, probably additional discounts, both for the Air Canada conditional order, which we expect, by the way, Don, to be firmed up in the weeks to come, and this Delta order.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, as you pointed out, this is probably heavily discounted. So what sounds like a $5.6 billion deal, maybe $2.5 billion of actual money. I wonder, is that really a financial lifeline or more or less just a project to keep the lights on and the manufacturing rolling along?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. I'm not sure I want to answer that one. But, you know, most new aircraft programs, and don't forget, this isn't just a new airplane. It's a new engine as well, the Pratt & Whitney 1500. So, you know, most aircraft programs, you expect to lose money on your first 50 aircraft. I expect Bombardier is going to lose money on more than just the first 50. So, you know, they had to do the deal. But the challenge for Bombardier now, and maybe even for the federal government and their consideration, this is our key question today, right? which is, right. as Bombardier ramps up production and then deliveries, that's what really starts to drain cash flow. I was looking at their balance sheet today. They got about $4.7 billion in cash and cash equivalents, including revolving lines of equity. By the way, don't forget, Quebec government has not yet remitted the $1 billion they promised to Bombardier. I think they're sort of waiting to see what Ottawa is going to do. So I'm not going to say I'm in support of aid necessarily, but I can understand that, you know, entering this critical phase of production deliveries, it's cash flow intensive. We've gone this far now. Do we want to let it die on the order paper, so to speak, or do we want to propel this forward?
I almost sound like you're saying this is, if the money comes from the federal government, it would be a hand up as opposed to a hand out.
Yeah, I mean, I look upon, you know, Ottawa assistance now as being one of a cash flow bridging mechanism. I still agree, though, and I think you would take the same perspective, that Ottawa just can't give the cash carte blanche. What's the oil patch going to say? What are other sectors of the economy going to say? And for sure, Ottawa has been looking at the Quebec Pension Funds deal for the train division of Bombardier, $1.3 billion there, with some pretty good terms and conditions on what is expected for that investment versus the Quebec government's billion-dollar promise into the C-Series program, very few terms and conditions. So I think Ottawa's got a right to ask for a return for the crown for the taxpayers of Canada. Maybe we can do that, with asset-backed securities or other ways to find some sort of return on investment for the taxpayer. But I would say we just can't, even though Bombardier will need some kind of bridge cash flow, we just can't give the cash. It has to be the right deal for the country.
Yeah, you're sensing the political consequences here very well, Robert. Final question, though. I mean, does this deal foreshadow other airlines piling in even before the plane takes to the skies, or do you think that's a long-term buy-in?
That is the great final question for me. I travel the world dealing with airlines from Kuwait Airways to airlines in the South Pacific, and aside from the question, was this aircraft a little bit too small, kind of nullified by the Delta order today, but we were surprised it was for the smaller CS-100. A lot of airlines have been sitting in the sidelines because, again, it's not just a new airplane, a new engine as well. And a lot of airlines want to see the litmus test of a major carrier giving it a seal, good housekeeping, seal of approval. That came with the Delta order. I would expect by end of the third quarter, beginning of the fourth quarter, we're going to see another three or four deals announced, a couple of which will be from some well-known airlines. Bombardier's got a bunch of deals still in the pipeline. I think this will be the trigger to really push them over.
All right. Sounds encouraging. Robert, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Don.
All right. The Prime Minister's very strong anti-ransom statement has at least one expert in hostage negotiations questioning if he's really willing to let Canadians die. The former head of consular services is up next. Please stay with us. Well, questions continue to swirl over Justin Trudeau's unconditional no ransom declaration in the aftermath of the execution of Canadian John Ridsdale by Philippine terrorists earlier this year, after that deadline for a ransom had passed. To discuss the reality behind the scenes, we're joined by seasoned hostage negotiator Gar Pardee. He's a former director general of the Consular Affairs Bureau, and he joins me in the studio. Mr. Pardee, I question whether Trudeau did the right thing. He spoke very forcefully. You've written that it was a bit of a public facade. So what's the reality when it comes to ransom and hostages in Canadian diplomacy?
Well, the ransom, certainly, in my experience, and goes back any number of years and any number of situations around the world, you go into the situation in which the Canadian finds himself held, and you try to find out what's going on, and you try to find whether or not there's an intermediary that you can use here, basically to see what the bottom lines are here in terms of getting that person released. But the objective in every case is to get that Canadian released, and in effect, having a hard theology up front again, under which you have to negotiate, mm-hmm. that makes it more difficult, in my view.
So Trudeau should have pulled a punch a bit on that one.
Yeah, I think so. And in particular, I think the key thing is here, what has been suggested here is that there's no negotiations. There has to be negotiations in these kinds of situations. I can't think of any government that would not engage in negotiations in this. Now, whether you're always successful, we were always successful. I think Mr. Mr. Redsoe was the first Canadian to die in those circumstances, certainly that I'm aware of. We've had one other that died, was an elderly lady in Afghanistan a few years ago, Miss Griesbach, but she died of ill health. It wasn't in the same circumstances as Mr. Redsoe. But other than Mr. Redsoe, the record has been pretty good in terms of getting people back home.
And the bureaus that you were, when you were in charge of it, sort of did about 100, you say?
Yeah, the period I was there, no, you mean, but these were the days when Colombia was the capital of kidnapping in the world, and every day there was somebody else, and they were effective. But the Colombians, the organization that was largely involved, it was FARC, it had an organization internal to itself that you could deal with. There was a high degree of predictability about what you were involved in. Today, of course, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars they collected. It was mainly Colombians, by the way, and in all of these situations, it's mainly the local people that pay the big price. Foreigners get the attention, of course, when they are captured. But today, you have FARC and the Colombian government negotiating some sort of a political agreement in downtown Havana. This is the only way that you can effectively deal with these kinds of situations.
All right, but Trudeau's had no direct or indirect negotiations. To me, that cuts off a pretty big avenue to reach into this terrorist group, for example, and make a deal.
Yeah, it was a pretty direct statement, but I'm used to rhetoric in government, and so you take a look at it, and usually what happens is that you find a way to say, well, these are your choices here, but I'm sure that he does not mean that he's willing to sacrifice the lives of Canadians in these kinds of situations. I mean, it goes without saying.
So do you believe if you have a no ransom rule, and you have the situation of Robert Hall still down there and John Ridstill who perished, their situation isn't hopeless if you don't pay money, or is it hopeless if you don't pay money?
It's probably with this group. You got to remember that the group that kidnaps these people, they want
money.
They want money or some other element in terms of what they're trying to achieve down there in the southern Philippines. So in effect, you take that as your starting point here. And by and large, it doesn't necessarily mean that the Canadian government is to pay the ransom if it's a monetary ransom, or somebody else will pay. I mean, there's other people that are involved in all of this. It's just not a one-to-one relationship by any means when you get into these negotiations.
What do you think is going over our consular affairs right now that you supervise? What are they doing?
Beards are turning gray, like mine did there. I mean, I think that's about it. These are intensive events, and there's nothing you can do other than work at them and really see what are the opportunities. But everybody in the world is going through the same thing. The idea that, you may recall, that this no ransom, no negotiation policy goes back a few years, but I'm not aware of any country in the world that has not been prepared, in effect, to make a ransom of one sort or another to get a national out of these kinds of difficulties. Everybody does it at the end of the day. It's as simple as that.
And is Robert Hall's family, if they're watching, should they have any hope?
Oh, I would think so. I would hope so. You mean if I was there, one of the very first things is that you have to, you talk to the families and you give them that hope and let them know that they are not alone in terms of trying to cope with this this particular situation. You mean that's part of the job that you have to do. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Pardee, it's always nice to have the voice of experience on this show. Thank you for coming in.
You're quite welcome. Yeah.
Okay, it's the most taxing time of the year as workers of the nation unite in filling out endless forms to ensure the government has received every last nickel of taxation on time. And after the break, we'll ask the author of a new study if the job is getting more complicated. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the deadline is Monday night to file your taxes without a late filing penalty. And if you're finding the forms more complicated than ever, well, you're not wrong, according to the Fraser Institute. Fiscal Studies Director Charles Lamam joins us from Vancouver. All right, Charles, I gave up a long time ago and just sent mine to the accountant. Is it getting worse for the public to fill out their forms?
That's absolutely right, Don. We've looked at how the tax code has evolved over the course of the past several decades, and we found that things are indeed getting more complicated. With this more complicated system, it means that it's more costly for Canadians to comply with it. And obviously it means it's more difficult for them to understand.
Okay, but what's causing that? Is it a conspiracy by tax accountants, or is it that there's just more loopholes or deductions or tax scales? What's causing this thing to get more difficult?
So we've measured actually the size or the space that the Federal Income Tax Act takes up over the last 40 years, and we found that it's grown in size of about 355%, about 2,000 more pages. Now, one of the reasons for why we're seeing that growing complexity is because of things like more tax credits, more boutique tax credits being added to the federal tax code. And so just in the last 15 years, we've seen the number of federal tax expenditures, as the government calls it, go from 103 to 128, just in the span of 15 years. And these credits add more complexity to the tax code, and that's one of the main contributing factors.
Yeah, but Charles, isn't the current government trying to eliminate some of those boutique tax credits and just make it a simpler one-off system?
Well, that is indeed welcome news. The former government, in fact, in every single budget since 2006, added at least a new tax credit to the tax code, increasing complexity. Now, the current government has expressed that, first, it's recognized that there is this growing complexity, and it's now committed to undertaking a review of the tax code. So I think this is a welcome news, and it actually puts Canada in a good position to enact major tax reform. The last time we saw fundamental tax reform in this country was in 1987. I think the Liberals can now take this opportunity where they review the tax code, they can eliminate all these ineffective tax expenditures, and in exchange, they can broaden the tax base and start to reduce rates for all Canadians, which in fact would be a simpler, more fair, and much more efficient tax system.
Yeah, I used to live in Alberta, and they introduced a flat tax there, but I gather they're thinking of changing it. Would a flat tax, a national flat tax, make sense?
Well, we've actually calculated, we've crunched the numbers, and we found that by doing away with 68 tax expenditures just at the federal level alone, the government can generate some revenues that would allow it to reduce tax rates and really only have two tax rates in the system, where virtually all Canadians would face a rate of about 15%, and just a small portion, about 2%, would face a higher rate of 29%. So yes, we can work towards a simpler system, one that has fewer tax brackets, and of course the benefit would be not only a simpler system, one that more Canadians would understand. It would mean lower compliance costs, and the great benefit of working towards lower rates is that it would benefit the economy. We would improve the incentives for people to do things like, you know, work, save, invest, and be entrepreneurial.
Maybe even reduce the temptation to go into tax havens and that sort of thing, right, Charles?
That's exactly right. If you look at when it comes to Alberta, for example, they used to have a single provincial rate. Unfortunately, that was done away with last October, and now the Alberta government has added five brackets to its personal tax system, and unfortunately, it's grown complexity. Look, if you look at all sorts of measures, unfortunately, the trend in Canada has been towards more complexity. For instance, we've calculated the total number of lines on the various provincial tax forms, and we found that in every single province, they've gone up. In Ontario, we have 194 lines now, instead of the 77 we had 15 years earlier. So there is this growing complexity. And again, it imposes real costs on Canadians when they go to comply. Yep. They have to spend time collecting their receipts over the course of the year, understanding all these tax rules. They may spend money on accountants or computer software. And unfortunately, it's the lower income Canadians that have that suffer the most, because they pay a greater share of their income to comply with the tax system.
Yeah. All right, Charles, thanks very much. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
All right. It is the annual day of mourning to remember those killed from workplace-related accidents. This year, the union leading the charge for safer working conditions has a specific target in its sights, asbestos. Well, let's find out more from Andrea Peart. She is our national representative for the Canadian Labour Congress. Joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Don.
Nice to have you with us. I find it incredible, frankly, that asbestos, you've called this the top occupational killer. How the heck is that possible? It's like no one carcinogen.
Excellent question. Every year we have over 2,000 Canadians that are dying from asbestos-related diseases.
2,000?
Yep, 2,000.
It's in their lungs, right? The fibers get in their lungs, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think a lot of Canadians are shocked to find out that just one fiber can kill you. And so if you imagine a worker cutting cement pipe for an infrastructure project, not aware that that cement is contaminated with asbestos, cutting into it, and then getting on public transit or, you know, a bus or a crowded subway on their way home, not even realizing that they're putting other people at risk.
Now, we got the flag on the Peace Tower at half mast today, and it's all actually all around Parliament Hill. But how many of those deaths, the 2,000 deaths, are actually workers who've got it unknowingly working in conditions they thought were safe but weren't?
It's a very difficult question to answer. Canada has very poor accounting systems for occupational disease. Mm-hmm. So the government isn't actually even aware of how many people are exposed. And it's hard to measure sort of perpetual improvement from that. So what we do know is how many people receive workers' compensation for mesothelioma. And as everyone knows, workers' compensation is not the easiest thing to get.
Right, right.
But last year we had about 400.
Wow. Now, one thing that kills me, the Parliament buildings around here are all being renovated and they're taking asbestos out of some of them, but there's still a lot of asbestos being used in construction, right?
That's correct. A lot of Canadians aren't aware that asbestos imports are increasing. Although our asbestos mines closed in 2012, in the past 5 years we've seen a steady rise, and now we're importing over $8 million in asbestos products. The bulk of it in brake pads and products that workers don't even get a warning on that it contains asbestos. So if you speak to your own mechanic and say, hey, does this brake pad contain asbestos? Is there something I can do? They don't even know. Yeah. So they can't even protect themselves.
Well, I saw a media investigation recently that showed that, you know, the government doesn't even know what buildings has asbestos. And as I said, the asbestos is fine, I guess, unless it gets disturbed and then the fibers get kicked up and then they get nailed, right?
That's right. That's right. So that's one of the reasons why we're calling for a comprehensive ban on asbestos, all forms of asbestos, so imports and exports, but we also want to see a registry of buildings which contain asbestos. And the registry has to be publicly available because we see a number of public buildings, and it could be a school, a university, a hockey rink, that are in a bit of a state of disrepair. And it's exactly as you said, when the asbestos is in a friable state, that those fibers become loose, and it just takes one fiber to kill you.
Are you getting any signals? I mean, the Labour Congress is pretty influential. Are you getting any signals the government's finally getting ready to move on something, some direction or other?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. The minister made an announcement today that there would be an announcement of an announcement to come, that there would be
an announcement
soon.
Okay.
Yes. So while we're pleased to hear that there will be an announcement, I really hope it'll be a comprehensive ban, and I really hope the announcement will come before Parliament goes into its summer recess.
Yeah, and if there's a ban, though, Andrea, how long does it take for the actual asbestos that exists in these buildings? It's going to take decades to get all this out of the building.
Well,
right?
Not all asbestos needs to be immediately removed.
Right.
It's about ensuring that we keep track so we know where asbestos is hiding, and the asbestos that's in a friable state needs to be locked away. But we need to know where it's hiding so people can protect themselves.
All right, Andrea, thanks for coming by, and good luck with that campaign.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, there's more bad news for the federal Conservatives in the latest Nanos numbers. And BC Premier Christy Clark is facing a political storm over a quiet salary boost from her party's coffers. We have experts on both issues up next. Please stay with us. Well, it's been 6 months of ho-hum in the polling business as the Liberals flourish under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, as in honeymoon ho-hums. But if anyone can make ho-hum interesting, it's Nick Nanos, our pollster extraordinaire, and here he is.
Thanks, Don.
How are you? New numbers out, elections held today, what happens?
We're still looking at a Liberal win, perhaps a romp, even better than the last federal election. You know, the Liberals are up and the Conservatives are down.
Why? What's driving this? I'm sorry, I gotta keep asking this question, like, you know, ho-hum.
Well, you know, the thing is you know, you look at the current state of play, mm-hmm. and a big part, you know, whether you love him or you hate him, a big part of the Conservative success last time and in the past 10 years has been Stephen Harper. We've taken Stephen Harper out of the equation, and the numbers for the Conservatives have started to drift towards other parties. So, and especially now, there's no counterpoint to the Liberals. There's no kind of what's the new vision for the Conservatives? A big question mark. So not great news for the Tories.
Well, that's what we're looking at here. I'm looking at the Conservatives are down 6%. Liberals up, 3.7. How worried should the Conservatives be by that?
Well, I think they should be quite worried, because what it means is, just think of it this way. The popular wisdom in the last election was that the core of Conservative support was 32%.
Rock solid.
The election wasn't great for the Conservatives. There was time for change, and the Conservatives were still able to hold on to 32%.
Right.
Well, not anymore. That's not the core. Now the core is 25.8%, which means that the Conservatives have been losing ground since the last federal election. And folks, so I guess kind of visualize this kind of bizarro world, at least for the Conservatives. Mm-hmm. There are people that voted for Stephen Harper and the Conservative Party last time that are now supporting Justin Trudeau and the Liberals.
Wow.
So if you're a Conservative, you've got to be worried about that.
Doesn't get any worse than that.
Yeah.
And yet the NDP, going through all this leadership angst, flatline, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You look at the NDP numbers, about 20% during the election, 19% now. So they're basically, I can't even say even Stephen. Can we say even Tom? We can't even say even Tom, because he's no longer the man.
No. Even question mark.
But for the New Democrats, what it shows is that they're basically at the same point as they were last time during the last federal election. Mm-hmm. They've been able to hold on to their support. They haven't noticed any kind of erosion. You know, you would have thought that perhaps the New Democrats would have lost ground to the Liberals, being the other progressive choice. Not the case. If people parked with the Orange Team last fall, they're still parking with the Orange Team today.
Is it because, though, in both these cases, particularly in the Conservatives, that they don't have a leader? I mean, there's an interim leader. It's all very nice, but Ron Ambrose is not going to run for the leadership, and so she won't be there in just over a year. So people go, well, it's easy to like the Liberals then, because you don't know what the deal is going to be with the Conservatives.
True, but we've got a new basement now. You know, in the polling world, we always look at parties and what their basement is. And the Conservative basement, which was 32% in the election, is no more.
Right.
It has ceased to exist.
Ceased to exist. Sounds like a parrot in a Monty Python movie.
Okay, yes, but not dead yet.
Not dead yet. I do want to ask you, though. I mean, you and I have this ongoing joke, because you said you would eat your hat if Justin Trudeau's popularity went higher than, I think it was 54%.
Yes.
Is still up there, though. But I think your hat-eating days might be behind you. But is it any sign that this honeymoon's wavering at all?
No, not really for Justin Trudeau. You know, when we ask Canadians who they would prefer as Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau is still the clear choice at around 50%, or one out of every two. He has a massive advantage over Rona Ambrose, who's at around 17%. Of course, she's the interim leader, but it looks like people are happy with the direction of the current government. They like what they've seen. And you know what? This guy's like the Energizer Bunny politically. He never stops. He's on the campaign mode. He's out seeing Canadians across the country day to day. He's out on the international stage, and he looks very proactive.
Nick, we're getting pretty good news out of Quebec today with the Bombardier deal, and sort of the loonies way up. It might break 80 in the next little while, but it hasn't already. What's the economic mood like? Are Canadians getting a little more confident in the way this economy is going?
Well, they're getting a little more confident on where they think the economy is going in the next 6 months, according to the Bloomberg tracking that we do. Mm-hmm. However, asked about their pocketbook, their state of personal finances, it's worse off now than it was a year ago. So they're feeling the squeeze in terms of their personal finances, but are a little more hopeful in terms of where they think things are going. And it speaks to a high level of uncertainty. We saw the governor of the Bank of Canada kind of be very cautious, and I won't use the word cagey, but cautious in terms of where he thought the economy was going. And that basically captures the mood of average Canadians. They're cautious, a little worried, but think things might be okay.
All right, all very interesting. Thanks, Nick, appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
All right, on a different topic altogether, there's nothing to see here, according to the Premier of British Columbia. Not so fast, says the opposition, as they attacked Christy Clark for collecting a $50,000 a year salary booster from her party's coffers. The story is the main topic around BC political water coolers. For the latest, we're joined by the Globe and Mail writer Ian Bailey. His part paper broke the story yesterday, and he's coming to us from Vancouver. Well, Ian, who's right here?
Well,
is much ado or much ado about nothing?
Well, I'm going to start, Don, by giving credit to my colleague Gary Mason, who has shed some very welcome light on some of the numbers here. The Premier of BC has received $277,000 since 2011, since she took the leadership of the party, $50,000 alone last year for her